To In It to Win It. This is Steve Barton, and I am back with Justin Hune of the Uranium Insider. Justin, thanks for coming back on the show.
It's my pleasure. Happy to be here with you again, Steve.
Yes, yes. Let me start off by saying we are not financial advisors. Do not take this as financial advice. Do your own diligence. This is simply what Justin and I are doing. Justin, what is your current outlook for the uranium market?
It's still very, very constructive, especially for the mid and long term. It is volatile and exciting in the short term. There's just so many elements, geopolitical elements, that are spinning around, kind of underpinning the current just overall supply and demand thesis. I think that how I could sum it up concisely would be that we are still very bullish on the sector, and that's based on overall supply and demand fundamentals, the growth of the sector, the growing positive sentiment for nuclear globally, and the recognition of a very fragile uranium market in terms of the fuel cycle. And so that recognition of the fragility essentially is sort of an understanding that it doesn't take much to disrupt that fuel cycle. And so the geopolitical situation currently, specifically with Russia, is actually disturbing and disrupting that fuel cycle.
Yeah. Okay. Let me go into, so for example, some of the things that might be disrupting it, like about a week or so ago, we had all over the news was Russia's attacking a nuclear power plant. There's a fire. It's going to blow up. And this ended up turning out to be a tough shed on fire out in the parking lot or something, right? I mean, it was, they completely blew it out of proportion. Is that right?
They did. It's very difficult to get accurate information halfway around the world when you're not physically there and don't necessarily have contacts that are on the ground in the present, you know, present skirmish in that particular situation. There was a decent amount of what seemed to be relatively accurate information being shared around on Twitter the night that it happened, that was doing its best David versus Goliath style of countering the blatant misinformation that was being put around. Part of that, I think, is to blame just simply for, you know, mainstream media outlets. Essentially, you know, fear is the biggest attraction of clicks and of views, and therefore, you know, ad revenue. And that's not unique to nuclear or unique to war or anything. That's just the way it is. There's so much competition for eyeballs now that it's like fear, 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 fear. And I think, you know, in hindsight, some of the statements that were made by government officials in Ukraine in terms of this could be 10 times worse than Chernobyl, which was blatantly false, that those sort of things, you know, who really knows the motivation of that, but speculating on that does seem like, or did seem like, you know, Ukraine was potentially trying to draw attention to garner support. That's also potential for that. But either way, yes, there was a fire due to what looked to be some fighting. The Russians claim that the Ukrainian saboteurs were the ones that actually did the attacking on that building. Ukrainians are, you know, claiming that Russia came in and started shelling the plant. We don't really know what exactly happened, but there was a fire. We were watching it on a live stream. It was very scary for about 30 minutes. And once we started getting accurate information coming in that the actual reactors were not being attacked, you know, the backup power systems were fine. The power was still on. We learned that 3 or 4 of the 6 reactors, it's a huge plant. It's a plant that's, what is it, 5,700, if I recall correctly, a megawatt plant. It's the largest in Europe. And that's across 6 reactors. And 3 or 4 of those 6 were already shut down just due to safety concerns before the skirmish because of the war. A 5th one was in the process of being shut down, and the 6th one was actually running at reduced capacity simply to leave the electricity on to keep the safety mechanisms running, the cooling of the reactor cores. And the fire was in an outbuilding, an administrative building, and over the course of about 90 minutes, maybe 2 hours, you know, all that information started coming in, and we were kind of like, oh, okay. So at the moment, you know, the uranium, the Australian market was open. And so the uranium miners that trade on the ASX just sold off really, really hard and then bought, you know, that dip was bought and printed these big, gigantic long candles, hammer candles. But so that, yeah, that situation seems to have dissipated. That plant is under normal operation, supposedly under the control of the Russians, but there's, you know, the staff running the plant is still there and it's everything looks normal and safe. But yeah, that was definitely an exciting moment last week for sure.
Okay. I got to believe Russia has no vested interest in blowing up a nuclear power plant, right? I mean, they want to take over Ukraine. They want to keep the power structure and they have no interest in blowing up bridges and stuff like that, right? I mean,
I don't want to really speculate on what their motivations are. Generally speaking, I don't know if they're trying to take over Ukraine. I don't know what the heck they're doing, but it doesn't seem strategically logical to create a radiation event right on the border of your own country, or in a country that you're attempting to take over potentially. So it doesn't seem strategic for either side to create that type of contamination. And these reactors, you know, these modern reactors, like the Zaporizhzhia plant that came under attack, you know, they have really robust safety mechanisms in place. Reactor cores have very, very thick, like multiple meters thick of concrete and steel containment. They're meant to withstand a 747 plowing into the side of them. So it would take an immense amount of very large shelling to actually breach those containments and cause a radiation event, in which case, you know, Russia has a nuclear arsenal. You know, if they wanted to drop nukes, they'd drop nukes. If they wanted to shell the plant heavily, they would do that. That's not what happened. That's not what's going to happen. So luckily that fear from that event has faded, because that seems like a strategic blunder.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I want to go into that a little bit. I've been telling people about uranium now for probably the better part of a year, and they always bring up Chernobyl and Fukushima, and they say, you know, you're just trying to pollute the world. Like, what are the safety factors that we've learned since Chernobyl that just don't exist now? Like you said, it's encased in concrete. Chernobyl was right. Not correct.
Correct. Yeah, Chernobyl did not have a concrete containment around the reactor core. And all modern reactors that are operating currently do. And that's obviously designed to protect the reactor from outside influence, like what's happening potentially now, or what, you know, people thought was potentially happening last week. But also, if there is some sort of meltdown type event within the reactor core, that it is contained. This is exactly what happened with Three Mile Island. You know, that was a partial meltdown of that reactor core, and it was contained, and there was not dangerous amounts of radiation on the outside of that plant. So it basically worked as it was supposed to in the containment work, the safety mechanisms did. After Fukushima, I would say the largest safety procedures and protocols that have been made more robust have to do with their backup cooling systems, because that's essentially what failed at Fukushima. Is once the electricity was cut off because of the tsunami, or because of the earthquake, then the tsunami came and it flooded their backup diesel generators, and those kept the water flowing. So, you know, nuclear reactors need a pretty consistent flow of fresh, cool water to keep the reactor cores from overheating. And so that's what failed at Fukushima, and that's what has been made more robust since that event globally.
Okay. Interesting. All right, where are we with the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, the SPUT, the SRUUF? They've surpassed 50 million pounds now, right?
50 million.
What's that?
50 million.
50 million pounds. Their net asset value is almost 3 billion. Now, the market cap in uranium, as far as all the publicly traded uranium space, is about 40 billion. Is that correct?
It's somewhere in that ballpark. Yeah, it's somewhere between 40 and 45. I haven't checked in a few days, but yeah.
Okay. Now, so SPUT has 2.75 of that 40 billion.
Right.
Wow. Okay. All right. I guess the point I'm getting at, the world, as far as we know, is going to need about 180, 185 billion, million pounds of uranium this year, correct?
Correct.
And SPUT is physically holding 50.
Correct.
So that's almost a third of the planet's annual supply.
Yep. Annual demand. Yeah, annual supply. It's almost half of the planet's annual supply. You know, we're expecting, or it's more than a third. We expect about 135 million pounds in primary supply this year.
Okay. Yeah. And SPUT will likely be on the New York Stock Exchange soon, in the next few months, maybe?
That application is still in process. Basically, what happens is the NYSE files the application on SPUT's behalf to the SEC. And so it's under review from the SEC currently. There will be a public comment period at some point in the next few months. It's definitely going to see some pushback from nuclear utilities in the States, even though it's a Canadian entity currently. But it's gonna have some pushback. I think the odds are still on their side. But I think that the last time we spoke, I probably would have given more weight to the importance of that NYSE listing. Clearly, large institutional buyers are not having a problem finding the TSX, judging by the volumes. You know, they've raised over $500 million on their ATM this year so far, you know, in the last 10 weeks. So there's no problem money finding the TSX. Of course, the New York Stock Exchange has far greater liquidity, and a listed options market would be very exciting for that vehicle. So that's, you know, we're hoping for it, but it's not really a deal breaker if it doesn't happen.
Yeah. It took me a little bit to find a brokerage account where I could buy it, but then it was no big deal. And after we did our last episode, I had a bunch of people email me like, I can't buy it. Where are you buying this? I got it on, where was it? I think TD Ameritrade allows it, and Interactive Brokers. Is that one of the ones you use?
Yeah, Interactive Brokers, they'll trade. I don't know if they trade the OTC ticker. They definitely, you can access, you know, the Canadian markets via Interactive Brokers, which is how I prefer to do it. This is actually a pretty liquid OTC ticker as far as OTC tickers go, but not all of the American brokerages will actually allow buying of SRUUF. Most of them do, but some of them don't, for whatever reason, because it's technically, they call it a foreign traded ETF. Okay. Most of them do. But either way, yeah, Interactive Brokers gives you access to international markets, and that's, you know, pretty easy to set up and start trading on that platform if you want access to the TSX, which is far more liquid, and you'll have better bid ask spreads too.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Now, moving on to the ETFs, URNM and URA. URNM is likely going to be taken over by Sprott.
Yeah, so far they have about a 92% approval in terms of the votes that they've brought in. What they're struggling with is because it's so widely held by retail investors. There's a lot of retail investors that hold a small number of shares, as they haven't reached their quorum yet. They need 50% of the shares outstanding, the holders of those shares outstanding, to vote yes or no. They will get a yes approval, but it's just going to take some time to get those folks pulled in. So right now the votes are rolling in, but if anybody listening to this owned URNM on December 15th, you can vote on this. That was the date of record. So if you owned it on December 15th, then please vote.
And how are we getting this? Is it through email, or do they mail us
something? Usually it's both. Usually you receive paper documents in the mail and or an email. I've heard from a number of people that they actually found the email in the spam folder and went back and were able to click through and vote. You also can call Sprott. In fact, John Champaglia gave me a number yesterday. I can provide that to you if you want to put it in the show notes or something.
Yeah, I will, because I haven't gotten anything in the mail, and I didn't think to check my spam folder, but I haven't gotten any emails on it. So
yeah, it might be there.
Okay, yeah. Maybe that's where it is, in the junk folder. URA has finished. Last time we were talking, they were in the middle of rebalancing and selling off some stuff to get SPUT in their holdings. And as I understand it, they got about a 6.5% allocation to SPUT. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. Now, looking between those two ETFs, URNM and URA, Cameco is by far the biggest holding. And URA is 24%. URNM is 17%. They both have a decent stake in Kazatomprom, 13% and 6%. They both have SPUT. They both have Denison Mines. I thought that was interesting. They both got about a 4 or 5% allocation of that. If you had to pick one now and only one, which one would you do? You are A, you are an M.
You are an M for
Okay.
sure.
You didn't even hesitate.
No, well, I mean, if you want pure exposure to uranium, then that's the more leveraged vehicle because it's 100%. URA is still only 70% allocated to pure uranium companies.
Okay. Okay.
And URNM has outperformed URA during this run so far.
Okay. Okay. All right. What the White House is considering sanctions on Rosatom. Now they're a nuclear power company in Russia, correct?
Correct.
And as I understand it, they have almost a fifth of the global nuclear fuel market. It's like 17% was what I found on their website. Is that?
That could be correct. I'm more familiar with their enrichment numbers and their the US's reliance. They provide about 20% of the enriched uranium to the US.
Oh,
And they're
okay.
40% of global enriched uranium. But that could be right in terms of total uranium product on the global scale. Yeah, you might be correct with that.
Oh, so what are the I don't see any allocation. Our average listener right now has SPUT, he has URA and URNM. Could that have any effect on those? Because I don't see Rosatom in the allocation of URA or URNM, right?
No, it's not publicly traded. It's essentially a state-owned corporation. It's owned by Russia,
Okay.
as a nation. So, as are all of the Russian corporations like 10X and TVEL and Uranium One, those are all, and they're all sort of kind of under this umbrella of Rosatom and owned by Russia. And so, a sanctioning of Rosatom would have implications on 10X, which is the big enrichment corporation. And like I said, they're 40% of global enrichment, and 20% of the enriched uranium for United States reactors comes from Russia. So yeah, that news hit last night. We haven't heard. There's been a couple more kind of whispers being shared around today in terms of that being official, but we don't know yet. We're seeing some kind of language come out of some folks from the United States, basically saying, as long as those sanctions, if they do come into play, are lifted within 2 years, then it shouldn't affect operations. But what they aren't saying is how it will affect prices.
Yeah.
And the reason he says that is because U.S. reactors, on average, have around 2 years of inventory. And so, but a lot of these reactors, even with that inventory, still have deliveries of nuclear fuel, and some of that is coming from Russia over the next few years. And so, it's a really big deal. If Russia ends up getting sanctioned, and we will see vastly increasing prices for all elements of the fuel cycle if that happens.
That's going to affect everyone from their electrical bill to everything. I mean, powering the oil and
True.
fuel plants and everything. I mean, like that's 20%. That's no small number.
Yeah, and I mean, and so, enriched uranium isn't necessarily 20% of the operating cost of the reactor. But 20% of the enriched uranium that comes into the US is coming from Russia. And that's limited by the Russian suspension agreement. So it probably would be more if not for that agreement, because Russia is a very reliable, low-cost producer and provider of uranium products throughout the fuel cycle. And so nuclear utilities love dealing with Russia. It's a one-stop shop, and it's always competitively priced. So, but yeah, it's still. Rising prices across the fuel cycle will definitely, in some markets, be passed on to the consumer.
So if they actually follow through with these sanctions, what is likely to happen to our bets on those three, on SPUT, URA, and URNM?
Well, I think we're already seeing what's happening to SPUT just leading up to this, and now it's still trading up pretty substantially today after that news came in last night. I was in SPUT essentially pretty closely tracking the price of uranium. We probably could see a 50% move in SPUT over the number of, probably a few months. That's entirely on the table. The equities here seem to be underperforming the physical. And so I think part of that has to do with what has already transpired in some other commodities over the previous months with these big price spikes in like nickel. Well, you'll see the physical commodity just absolutely skyrocket, but the equities, you know, they've done well, but they aren't moving along with the commodity, because a lot of times the market believes that this is going to spike and come back in relatively short order. And something like this, like a geopolitical tension that would cause this event, that could technically reverse, you know, relatively short order. So whether or not we'll see the equities follow suit, I'm not sure. In my personal opinion, what's happening currently is definitely highly influenced by a speculation on the potential for Rosatom to be sanctioned, right? That's definitely having an influence on the physical uranium market and the prices. But I don't think that what we'll see is a sharp reversal in prices if that dissipates, because the market is simply just so constrained and so thin right now. And it's largely dictated by inflows into SPUT, because they're the biggest player in the spot market. And you can see we're seeing big price movements on relatively small amounts of uranium purchased. And so, and I spoke with John Cempaglia yesterday, the CEO of Sprott, and he was telling me that there's that basically they're seeing a number of sellers that they've been able to rely upon in the spot market over the past number of months just sort of not call them, you know, and just kind of like hold on to their material more tightly. And it doesn't seem like the general geopolitical situation with the West versus Russia, to oversimplify, is about to just go back to quote unquote normal. I'm hoping that the actual kinetic fighting stops soon. That's obviously not something that, you know, anyone would celebrate. But it doesn't seem like we're just about to go back to normal. I'm not getting that feeling. And I think that regardless of whether or not there are sanctions put in place, there's just some risk to this jurisdiction now that isn't about to go away. And so I think that's going to keep some constraint on the nuclear fuel market for the potential mid to long term. And it should be, I think once the sharp news points that we're hearing now play out or reverse or whatever, and we get through this volatile period, then I think we'll continue to see a steadily rising price. And at some point the equities will go, oh, this is for real. And they'll keep going.
No. Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to share my screen here real quick. I want to, so if you guys are listening on the podcast, just click on the link down below and it'll take you straight over to YouTube, and you can see what Justin and I are looking at. Okay. So I'll go to the middle one here. This is daily chart. You can see the graph, right, Justin?
I can.
Okay. Yeah, so we've gone, let me move this over a little bit here, something like that. So just today, we've gapped up. This is the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. I mean, we went from, I don't know, 1375 or something, boom, right up to like 1450 just in one day. It's really getting a nice, I mean, maybe we're approaching kind of a top here. But yeah, I guess I'm just happy to see that what I've been thinking about for the last year or so is actually starting to pay off.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous chart. I mean, that what was that? What would you call that? That there was a kind of a triangle pattern that it did break out of. It wasn't exactly a bullpen.
Coming right down here, like
long term. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It broke out, back tested, it broke out again. And that previous resistance point that you noticed from September, that the vehicle was actually at close to a 20% premium to NAV at that point. And right now it's actually trading probably at a slight discount to NAV at that height. So we have the spot price of uranium behind us at this point in supportive of this move, rather than a speculative, you know, investing frenzy in the vehicle that far outpaced the movement of the spot price. So the market's very different already from September to now.
Yeah. Here's URA. They all kind of seem to follow the same graph. You know, once I got into gold, you realize that, Newmont and Barrick Gold, they kind of follow each other, and they follow the gold spot price, you know, and these are just kind of a leveraged bet on that. Here's URNM, real nice above the 200-day moving average. I mean, I'm pretty excited. I like this a lot. What What are your thoughts on the Uranium Royalty Corporation? What do you think of them? It's kind of an interesting play, right? I mean, they have rights just like a gold royalty or silver royalty or copper or take your pick. This is one of the only uranium royalty plays. Is that correct?
It is the only one.
It is the only one. Okay.
Yeah. Exciting. Yeah. I mean, some companies own streaming royalties on projects, but it's the only, you know, stock that you can own in the uranium space that's, you know, purely royalties. You know, this one surprised to the upside for me. And I've come to realize that the people that built this vehicle know what the heck they're doing. They're very sharp. It's the CEO, Phil Williams, and some other prominent players in the space. He also is the CEO of Consolidated Uranium. They just did a spinoff of Labrador Uranium that just started trading a few days ago. So this one actually surprised me to the upside, to be completely honest. I was pretty unimpressed with their stack of royalties when they first IPO'd, but they've added some pretty impressive royalties over the past year and a half. And, you know, if we actually think we're going to see sustained high prices, this thing could actually become cash flowing. And obviously, from a technical perspective, it looks, you know, pretty nice, like the rest of the space. Got all of these moving averages moving up. And, you know, some of the other stocks, you'll like check out, go to the Cameco chart if you can.
Here we go.
Yeah. So see, I love the way these moving averages just stack on top of each other and then they all just point up simultaneously. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I did an episode on this recently. It didn't get much traction, but I basically think of them like soap bubbles, you know, and you can literally see what the world betting on this is thinking, you know, and they act like little resistance or support soap bubbles, or they act as resistance to them, you know, so it's kind of nice to see all these moving averages underneath it like that, where you just have all of them as support and right. Nothing up there is resistance except the previous highs. Very cool. Very cool. Yeah. I'm super excited about this, Justin. I'm just, thank God I found it. My brother told me about it and I didn't listen until I missed a 30% move.
Nice. Nice. Well, I think you had a pretty good entry on Sprott, the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. So I think that's just a really good, has great liquidity. It tracks the commodity. In my opinion, it's probably the safest bet in the space. And it's more of a sure bet. And even in the recent near term, it's been outperforming the equities over the past week. Yeah, so that's kind of, I find that very curious. And I think it's a great vehicle. Yeah.
Yeah. I like it a lot. The first one I got was, I think, $11 a share or maybe $11.50. And then when I backed up the truck was when it hit $10.50. And I look like a genius now on the graph.
Yeah. Nicely done.
Hindsight's 2020. Yeah. That I could thank my mentor in technical trading for that. All right, cool. Well, you have a newsletter. Listeners can go check out uraniuminsider.com and they can sign up. And check out your YouTube channel as well. We'll put a link in that Uranium Market Minute. I love that.
Thank you.
You know, maybe 3 to 5 times a week, you put out a little 15 to 20 minute video and just kind of give everyone updates at the end of the day. It's very cool. It's very cool.
Nice. Thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah.
Yeah. And you are also going to be a part of Rick Rule's Uranium Bootcamp, correct?
Correct. Yeah. That's next Saturday, March 19th. I'm really looking forward to that. In particular, there's the two guys that run, what is it? WMC Energy, I believe. I might be messing up that acronym, but I think it's WMC Energy. And they are the traders that function for Sprott. So they're the guys that are actually out in the spot market on a daily basis trying to find pounds for Sprott. And they're presenting. And in my opinion, that's worth $100 just to listen to that presentation. But obviously, they're, you know, John Cipaglia is speaking. And then I'm going to be on a panel with Rick Rule and Lobo Tigre. It's going to be super exciting. Uranium-focused conference. It's going to be super fun.
Yeah, I mean, he's got the CEO of Cameco. Adam Prom is going to be speaking. I'm super, super excited. You know, and that's another thing, too, is it's like this market is so small. I got to believe that. Callie told me when they anticipate over 7,000 people entering this, right? there has got to be some heavy hitters and high net worth individuals that are going to be participating in this class. And I would imagine after the class, sometime after March 19th, within that week, I can't imagine a scenario where the uranium market goes down after that. Can you? I mean,
it's, yeah, I'm sure there's going to be a number of new entrants into the space following that.
Yeah, there are guys like me doubling down. But, yeah, okay, well, thank you, Justin. We'll put your links in the show notes. We'll put a link to Rick Rule's upcoming Uranium Boot Camp. Justin and I will be there, and you'll actually be a part of the show, so that's very cool. Thanks again for coming on, and you have a good rest of the day, sir.
Always my pleasure. Yeah, welcome to check anytime. Thanks, Steve.
All right, man. Take care.